From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 80 of Little Brother for the 9th of April, 2022. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Apple AirTags are small location tracking devices a little bit larger than a US quarter. In and of itself, an AirTag is essentially just a beacon. It uses a combination of Bluetooth and NFC to make its presence detectable by Apple devices. Apple devices that detect one can report its location so that it can be found and can also communicate back to the tag to cause it to make a sound. They don't talk to any larger network directly, for instance via Wi-Fi or cellular data, but instead are reliant on Apple devices to relay their presence. To my understanding, all iOS devices participate, regardless of whether or not the tags detected to belong to you, essentially forming a large surveillance network. As a privacy measure, Apple devices will alert you if someone else's AirTag has been detected in your presence consistently in order to prevent them from being used to track your location. However, Android devices haven't been able to do the same until now. A new tool has been published via the F-Droid open source software repository. It is called AirGuard. It searches for trackers and saves a local copy of all of them that it finds. If a tracker has been observed 3 times in different locations, it notifies you, bringing up the protection that Apple users have had right from the start. The United States Postal Inspection Service is the post office's law enforcement arm. I bet you didn't even know they had one. Their ostensible purpose is to enforce federal laws concerning things like mail fraud, dangerous packages, counterfeit postage, things like that, which you would expect the post office to need to be able to enforce if you were ever to think about it. However hard you think about it, though, you would be hard-pressed to figure out how they thought it was their business to establish a program called the Internet Covert Operations Program, a program that very cutely forms the acronym ICOP. Yes, they do use a lowercase I. And how that program was involved in the monitoring of social media for inflammatory posts and those associated with protest movements, both left and right. How much mission creep are we talking about here? Well, our old friends Clearview.ai were used as part of the ICOP program. It's not really exactly clear why. I don't have a clear view of that. Well, the House of Representatives couldn't figure out why either, and they sicked the Office of the Inspector General on the program, and they in turn issued a report that, much like us, tells on Big Brother. The Postal Inspection Service appears to disagree with the findings that the ICOP program has nothing to do with the mail and appears disinclined to terminate or attenuate it. It's not exactly new for apps made available in the Google Play Store or other repositories for Android to include data harvesting capabilities. The search giant has started to give the heave-ho to applications that surreptitiously harvest data from Android users. At the head of the list is a Panamanian company called Measurement Systems, which has developed a software development kit, or SDK, that is in turn paying other app developers to roll it into their apps, with developers making anywhere from $100 to $10,000 per month for their efforts. The SDK in turn aggregates data from all of the users of all of the apps using it and puts it right into measurement systems' hands. Where does it go from there? Well, according to the Wall Street Journal, Measurement Systems has a Virginia-based subsidiary called Packet Forensics LLC, which does business with the U.S. government. Big brother, you are so busted. For their part, Google is removing the apps using the SDK from the Google Play Store, probably in an effort to eliminate competition. Hard as it may be to swallow, sometimes Big Brother actually looks after us. Apparently, the federal government has been actively removing malware from infected machines around the country as a way to prevent Russian strikes on American infrastructure. The targeted malware enabled the Russian attackers to build botnets controlled by the Russian Military Intelligence Directorate, known as the GRU. Secret court orders were issued, apparently not kept all that terribly secret, authorizing the action through which the FBI and Justice Department were able to disconnect the infected servers from the GRU by removing the malware with or without the knowledge and cooperation or even consent of the individual infected system's owners. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week? This week's winner is email marketing firm MailChimp. MailChimp were compromised by way of social engineering. The intruders were able to talk a MailChimp employee into granting them access to the bespoke administrative tools used within the company. The compromised employee's access was quickly disabled, however, not before the attackers examined around 300 user accounts and made off with audience data for 102 of them. Targeted customers were in the cryptocurrency and finance businesses. I am sure you've all heard the expression, same shit, different day. Days turn into weeks, which turn into months and years and decades, and it seems even so, some of the battles that we have been fighting remain unchanged. A perfect example of this can be found in an article that appeared last week on Cyber News. The article talks about how stress causes employees to break cybersecurity policies. Of course it does! Those of us who work in IT understand, at least theoretically, why the cybersecurity policies are important. The rank and file outside of IT? Not so much. Management? Maybe, but probably not. None of this changes one simple thing, though, and that is that we've got work to do, and we want to get it done if for no other reason than to get the management to stop bothering us about it. In short, it's about stress. IT systems in many organizations are not well handled. It isn't that the workers who build and maintain these systems don't want to do a good job or to make these systems run smoother. Some of us are even passionate about the work that we do. But the problem is that businesses so often view IT as a cost center rather than a profit center, and that tends to leave IT starved of resources. No. You can't have the server upgrades that you need to make the email run fast, but make it run fast anyway. On top of that, decisions that should be design decisions made by engineers are instead made by managers who choose the product that had the slickest sales pitch. Ooh, shiny. Even though the product has features that you will never use, lacks features you need, requires 10 servers to do the work of 2, and still runs dog slow. Does that sound like the voice of experience? Many of the processes are viewed as cumbersome, and maybe they are. You've got to put this app on your phone, And when you want to log into that system, this app will ping you to ask you if you're logging into that system, you know, just to make sure you're you. Or maybe you need to have an app or a little key fob that shows you a 6-digit number, and you've got to pull that up and or take that out every time you want to log in. What a pain in the ass, right? And don't even get me started on password policies. Your password must contain at least one uppercase letter, one lowercase letter, 3 punctuation marks, 2 digits, but they can't be on the start or end, plus at least one Greek, Cyrillic, or Hangul letter. Must be at least 20 characters long, can't have more than 3 characters in common with the last 12 passwords you used. Oh, and we're going to ask you to change it in a month and nag you until you do. This, combined with a desire to get the boss off your back, is how policies get broken. Maybe a publicly available calendar app proves to be handy, maybe more handy than whatever app the company is using, so people start using that instead. And now a company that isn't yours knows your company's schedule. Maybe the team doesn't understand how to use a NAS that the company spent tons on and instead goes and uses Dropbox or WeTransfer to share work files amongst the team because it's easier. And now a company that isn't yours has your company's data. Maybe Gmail works every time and the company's internal mail server is touchy. Now a company that isn't yours has your company's communications. I don't claim for a minute to have a solution to the technical aspects of these problems, except to adequately fund and staff your IT departments, and for fuck's sake, let the IT department make the technology decisions. Unfortunately, that is, as they say, way above my pay grade to sort out. All I know is that I have personally been arguing this matter for decades, and I can prove it. On November 19th, 2000, almost 22 years ago, I published episode 1 of this show, and I talked about this very issue in that episode. As the saying goes, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So I'm here today with Ethan Gregory Dodge, who's here to talk a little bit about something that is intruding into our everyday lives. Ethan, thank you and welcome to Little Brother.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, I'm glad to have you here. For starters, tell us a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, so I am a freelance journalist based in San Jose, California, and I really, really dig reporting about privacy and surveillance. I actually have a background in cybersecurity in the tech industry and am currently pivoting away from tech and towards more journalism. So there's a lot of great stuff happening, a lot of great articles coming out in all over the country, but not really so much here in San Jose. And I noticed that there was a lot happening in terms of surveillance in San Jose, so I decided to start reporting on it myself.
Very good. So I promised my audience that I was going to be talking in this episode about ALPR, and I understand you have a little bit of expertise on the front, so I was wondering if you could tell us, what is ALPR?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call it expertise, but I can definitely lend some knowledge there. So ALPR, is, or some people will just say LPR, but ALPR is definitely the most common. It stands for Automatic License Plate Readers, and it is the technology of essentially taking video footage from a camera and uploading it to some algorithm that then recognizes the license plates of cars, motorcycles, vehicles, right? And then saves that license plate, the time that it saw it, and the geolocation. And then in some cases, some of the algorithms will also save other things like bumper stickers, the car's make and model, the car's color, stuff like that.
It seems to me as though these are all things that a casual observer could sit and write down in a notebook or take photos as cars pass by. How does ALPR differ from that sort of activity?
Well, it effectively gives whoever is deploying ALPR, be it the police or a private business, the ability to monitor any point where they put a camera without having to actually put a person there. Like for policemen, police departments are extremely interested in this type of technology because they get to see where all cars within their jurisdiction and possibly even beyond are going, where they've been, at what time, stuff like that, and without having to put an officer at every street corner.
So the bonus that ALPR gets you above conventional surveillance is that it's all automated and does not require personnel to carry out.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So who are Flock Safety?
Yeah, so Flock Safety, they are a startup out of Atlanta, Georgia, and they are the hot name in the ALPR space right now. One officer in North Carolina actually described them as the Ring doorbell for ALPR, and I find that description very apt, because the reason why police officers love Ring is because the footage from all these people's porches is being uploaded to a central location in Amazon's cloud or Ring's cloud infrastructure, right? Which in turn they can access, be it through a warrant, or sometimes they actually can circumvent the warrant process and just ask members of their community to share the data with them, which legally is not circumventing the warrant process. However, it has been shown that Ring actually trains these officers on how to put pressure on the residents to share the video data, right? And so Flock is very similar in that it also has a cloud model. You use one of their cameras and it uploads it, all the footage, to the cloud, and then it runs it through the license plate reader algorithm and saves that all that data that we talked about. And Flock, by the way, is one of those that will save the cars, make and model, any bumper stickers, the color. If you have like a roof rack or something like that, it'll note all of that. And then officers can then ask private businesses that have Flock, or just private residents, if an individual resident has a Flock for whatever reason, to share that data with the police department so that they can further their investigation with that data too.
Okay, that actually takes us a few steps past where I was going next. So let me jump ahead a little bit and just ask you, who besides government agencies and governments and law enforcement is able to purchase a Flock camera and deploy it?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine anyone that's willing to give Flock the money could deploy it. They cost just under $2,500. I believe that also includes access for a year to look at the data. At least in SJPD's case, San Jose Police Department's case, they paid $2,500 per camera and a year's subscription to the data that their cameras were collecting. That might differ from customer to customer. I know a lot of Flock customers, in fact, Flock actually encourages their customers to only keep the data for 30 days, but for whatever reason, San Jose keeps it for a year.
For instance, then could a neighborhood association or some party like that purchase a set of Flock cameras and that's available to them?
Yeah, and that's actually, like, it's my understanding that that's one of their bigger markets outside of police departments. And there was a piece that Motherboard wrote just over a year ago now, in which they talk about homeowners associations across the country using Flock and it actually causing problems within the neighborhood because the placement of these ALPRs were controversial and whatnot. But yes, and actually in my investigation of San Jose, I actually learned that there are 30 private entities. I don't know if they are HOAs or we have quite a few malls in San Jose. I would imagine that most of the malls here have ALPRs, and 30 of those customers, according to the city, they want to share that data with SJPD.
Do you happen to know if these third parties that own cameras, does the subscription include access to ALPR data from other subscribers?
So that's kind of a black box. I have no reason to believe that Flock is allowing private entities to view other customers' ALPR data.
Okay, that's at least something positive. Now, does it also have with it the ability to look up the license plate in a state database or anything along those lines? Or is it strictly by association? It says this license plate was here and you have to figure out on your own beyond that.
Yeah, no. So Flock does provide the ability to upload hot lists. Mm-hmm. And those are, like you say, it's a state database or a national database or wherever they're getting it. of cars that are either stolen or there's like an Amber Alert out for them or something like that. And to the normal person that isn't necessarily familiar with these issues, that might sound great. Oh yeah, there's an Amber or Silver Alert out for this car. Let's get it right away and let know where it's going, and then the cops can show up. But the problem is Brian Hofer, who lives here in Oakland, California, he is actually in Oakland. They have a Citizens Privacy Commission, and he is the executive chair of that commission. And so he's actually working with city council on a regular basis with surveillance issues. And he rented a car one Thanksgiving, and it just so happened that car was in one of these databases because it had been stolen actually down here in San Jose, but he had rented it up in Oakland. And what happened was he drove past an ALPR in Contra Costa County, California, and was then pulled over and held at gunpoint by multiple officers because they thought that he had stolen the car. But when in fact he was totally innocent, and what actually ended up happening was the agency that marked the car as stolen forgot to take it off the list.
Okay, so to be clear, what happened was the rental company had the car stolen from them, or at least they believed it had been stolen. They put it on a hot list, and then they forgot to clear it, and this poor customer of theirs got the brunt of it.
Exactly, and it was just really ironic that it just happened to be like the foremost privacy and anti-surveillance activist in Oakland.
Wow.
That has happened to many, many other people. Brian Hofer has told me himself, and I actually quote him in an article saying that he's lucky because he's white, and if he were a person of color were held up in that situation, which has actually happened many, many times, it could be much scarier. There was a black mother of 3 or 4 children in a minivan in Aurora, Colorado, who pretty much the exact same thing happened to her, except her car was mistaken for a stolen motorcycle in the state of Montana or something like that. And her and her kids were dragged out of the car and held at gunpoint. And that is not a safe situation for anybody, but especially not for a black family.
Now, in that particular instance that you just described, are we talking about a case where there was a match, but it was a different state on the license plate number, or was it a misread, or what would we have there?
It's my understanding that she had the same license plate number as a stolen motorcycle or stolen vehicle in Montana, but hers was a Colorado license plate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In your writing about the ALPRs out in San Jose, you've mentioned the hot lists earlier in this interview, but you've also made mention of lists produced by fusion centers. What can you tell me about fusion centers?
Yeah, so fusion centers, this is actually a really touchy topic in San Jose, and that's actually how Brian Hofer got his start in this activism, was that they were building a fusion center in Oakland, and he didn't like that idea. And fusion centers they're essentially a facility where law enforcement agencies in a given region can share their intelligence and share their evidence, such as their automatic license plate readers. And ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is very fond of these fusion centers. And the reason why that is such a touchy subject in San Jose specifically is that San Jose is a sanctuary city, and our law enforcement does not aid ICE in any of their investigations.
Sure, yes, I understand. I understand the kind of arrangement. We have a couple of sanctuary cities in this area as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one point that San Jose, that the mayor and city council, when they voted for these cameras, that they made very explicit that this data would not be shared with ICE. However, when I asked in a follow-up if they were going to share it with any other law enforcement agencies, they just said it will not be shared with ICE. So that's all I got.
That does give one pause to question whether or not it ends up being shared with ICE just using a third agency as a proxy.
Yeah, there have been situations like that. There have also been situations in which ICE was accessing a central database with data from sanctuary cities in it. And that's another problematic thing about Flock, is that they take all of their customers' data and they aggregate it in an anonymized form. They say that it can't be identified back. I don't know exactly what this data aggregation looks like. If they're saving the license plate numbers, I don't know how they can claim that it is de-identified and anonymous. License plates, by definition, are not that, right? However, I don't know if they are saving the license plate numbers. That's a big black box, right? Whatever Flock is doing with that themselves, and then if they are in turn giving access to that database to federal authorities, we honestly don't really know. And there are a lot more questions that Flock needs to answer for.
Okay. So you've written about the installations in San Jose. Can you tell me a little bit about the funding for those and how that was carried out?
Yeah, so back in September, San Jose City Council approved a pilot program funded with $10,000 to obtain and test automatic license plate readers and place them at one of the busiest intersections in the city. Just about 2 months later, they approved another $250,000 out of the city's COVID relief funds to obtain more automatic license plate readers. But mind you, they still hadn't even started the pilot. And here they are allocating even more funds, $250,000 of COVID relief funds. And at the time, in the entire Bay Area, there were a lot of smash and grab robberies that were happening. People running into retail stores, breaking open a window, and making out with the cash register in the middle of the night. And several media outlets and also the police and many politicians made it to seem like it was this big rise in property crime, when in fact it wasn't necessarily. And property crime is actually at a pretty all-time low. I don't know if I can say for sure that it's at an all-time low in the Bay Area, but it is extremely low compared to the history of the Bay Area. But they used that fear to justify using $250,000 of COVID relief funds and saying that crime was driven by the pandemic. I don't know how they're justifying that, but anyway, and it was actually approved unanimously. And come to find out, there's actually a little bit of ulterior motive on the part of our mayor as well. He right now, he's actually lobbying for a California state law that would give San Jose more cameras in their city to be able to detect speeding. Essentially, the California state law would be a pilot program of close to like a dozen cities across the state, one of them being San Jose, to test these new cameras that can detect speeding, because San Jose has a really high traffic fatality rate right now. And so what he wants to do is actually use the ALPRs to then detect cars that are speeding or otherwise breaking the law, and then use the California DMV to find out who the owner of that car is, and then text the owner of the car and ask them to either slow down in the future or not do what they're doing. And they have allocated about $50,000 to do that.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like to talk about on this topic?
Shortly after SJPD and the city decided that they were going to go with Flock, the ACLU, big ACLU, released a report, not just on automatic license plate readers, but specifically on Flock and the concerns about Flock. And they had several suggestions. They laid out in a lot of detail. The page is 13 pages long, and they lay out in detail all of their concerns. And then at the end, they have a list of suggestions, that law enforcement agencies should implement if they're going to use Flock. And one of them that I thought was really interesting that I actually was not aware of before this report is that the state of New Hampshire actually requires that automatic license plate reader data only be kept for 3 minutes and then be purged from the system. And the idea is that in that 3 minutes, if it is on a hot list, that it can then be saved after those 3 minutes. But if it's not on a hot list, it will immediately be deleted, because then it cannot become this dragnet. These are the words of the ACLU. It cannot become a dragnet surveillance system, right? And like I said, the leading school of thought here is that the shorter the time window is of data retention for ALPRs, is that the smaller the window for abuse. And that's why Flock actually encouraging customers to just do it for 30 days is slightly encouraging. However, 30 days can still be a lot of data about the whereabouts of your residents in your city, right? And so, yeah, I thought that was very interesting that, yeah, the state of New Hampshire, apparently law enforcement can only keep it for 3 minutes.
Wow. That's a neat one. I didn't expect to hear that. All right. And I like to also offer you an opportunity, if you have any other projects that you're working on that might be interesting to a cybersecurity and privacy oriented and hacker audience.
Yeah. I mean, that's all of the topics that you just listed are stuff that I love to report about, especially their intersection with policing and racial justice. So I do have a lot of projects and stories and reporting in flight that I'm actually not at liberty to talk about right now. However, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm EGD, those are my initials, Ethan Gregory Dodge _IO on Twitter.
All right, excellent. Ethan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ethan Gregory Dodge is a freelance journalist covering surveillance and policing. We spoke earlier this week. We have some listener mail. Snackness wrote in to say, "So I've been listening to Little Brother, and I have a number of comments for this Mr. C. Ritter fellow should I ever have a chance to meet him, but here's one point I'm particularly unsure of. Am I supposed to be patching my system? Let me check the tape on that. Patch your systems!" Yeah, I would say definitely. He continues, "It's too short. I could listen all day, but each full episode could fit into just the intro of one Marc Maron episode. Without extra work, it just means talking slower, with more pauses, and editorializing more. I can get news elsewhere, and I'm sure your aggregation is unique, but your opinion is what I can only get from you, and I think that's the most valuable part." You know what? That's a completely valid critique. I added an editorial to this episode with your request in mind, and I'll see what I can do about putting in more opinion pieces. As with the Pwn of the Week and the Fail of the Week, I don't really necessarily have one every week because those are dependent on other people fucking up, but this request really isn't so much dependent, so let me see if I can keep it going. He continues, "My only other quibbles are with the sound. Your voice is very bassy, and there isn't much frequency isolation between your voice and the music." Well, Snackness, I am a baritone, and there's not much I'm willing to do about that side of the formula. I have bumped up the volume drop on the ducking function for this episode, and that should make the music a bit quieter when I'm speaking. Let me know if that helps. "The outtakes you put at the end of the recent episode were so fun," he says. "You know, I want to do that more often, but the truth has been that in recent weeks, the takes have actually been pretty clean, which is perversely frustrating. But I can tell you, by this point in the show, that there have been enough that there's going to be a round of outtakes at the end of this episode, so stay tuned. I love it, and I wanted to share. Thank you for sharing your labor of love with us. An hour in, and I was ready to join the fan club and buy tickets to the tour." Well, damn. I really appreciate that, man. Thank you for listening, and thank you for writing. If you would like to join the conversation, as I've mentioned at the start and end of the show, drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. And what say you all? Should I get up on some other platforms as well? I'm open to suggestions there. Just don't ask me to rejoin Facebook. I quit them like a bad habit 6 months ago, and I ain't going back. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Ed, Azriel, and Snackness for story leads this week, and to Ethan Gregory Dodge for appearing on the podcast. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwned music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email, critter@littlebrotherpodcasts.com. That's three times this episode you've heard that. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. However hard you think about it, a program very cutely that forms the acronym. I'm going to get that fucking word out. That ICOP program has nothing. Secret court issues were ordered. Authorizing the action through which the FBI and the Justice Department Mm-hmm. Ethan Gregory Dodge is a freelance journalist covering surveillance and policing. Policing, yep, mm-hmm. Editorializing, mm-hmm, yeah. Patch your systems or Big Brother will patch them for ya.